Session number 12922, Squadron Leader Ronald Meredith, Rail 5.
Yes, the base, I think it's important that perhaps one should have a perception of what we're talking about this base. You've got a runway which is well over a mile long. You have facilities for over 2,000 people. This means not just accommodation and bed spaces, but every type of welfare facility that these people could imagine. A large bowling alley, for example, what the Americans call the PX, we used to call the NAFI in written military terms. Commissariat, which is part of the BX, Class 6 store, which is a liquor store. Basically, all the wherewithal for shopping, although I said earlier, and I say again, many people do still shop off base. You have a large hospital, you have elaborate medical and dental facilities, church, which covers all persuasions. You have messes for the officers, for the senior NCOs, for the troops. You have other recreation facilities, sports fields, you name it. All these facilities are there, together with the operational administrative facilities on the base. A very large communications centre, for example, pamphlet, radio communications, telex, fax, normal telephone exchange. Elaborate facilities in that nature. And the whole base, to keep a base of that size going, requires a large number of people. Not just those who are going to operate the missiles, who are going to drive the missile transporters, who are going to maintain them, who are going to guard them. You've got cooks, you've got clerks, you've got administrative staff, military American, Royal Air Force regiment personnel, American civilians, British civilian staff, all working within this 9-mile-odd perimeter of a base, the bulk of which is actually handed over to the airfield. And this is quite a large operation by anyone's standards. In fairness, one must also say that although this is designed for the Americans to operate crews, with the Brits providing one-third of the security force, because the base has been there for a very long time and there's a terrific rapport between the native Brit community in and around Newbury and the Americans, of course, a lot of these facilities are also available to the British. It's not unreasonable if you've got a large number of sort of single unmarried fellows that local talent is something they're going to go looking for. So they will have dances which bring up the single girls, but also the sporting activities, social events, dances, bingo, for goodness sake, parties, band concerts, all these things bring the local community onto the base. And this provides this close association between the base and the community. And in this, I mustn't forget Welford. Welford is an adjunct to Greenham Common. The majority of the Americans at Welford live at Greenham Common. Although they operate at Welford, and the two bases are operated synonymously. The base commander, the wing commander, who's the senior guy on the American base at Greenham, is also responsible for the activities at Welford. So the two are quite interlinked, and the social activities operate quite closely between the two bases. It's a big feature of the local community, or it was a large feature of the local community, and involves a lot of people. And I did say before that quite a lot of Americans live off base and spend their money downtown. This is very true, and the number of Americans, as the numbers built up, then it was evident there were more and more Americans to be seen downtown Newbury. And I think it's fair to say that there were no more problems with the Americans downtown than you would have if there had been a large British garrison on the doorstep. And this worked remarkably well. The other feature of activity at this time is something which is again worth mentioning, and that is related to the construction side. I've already mentioned that as far as the missile store is concerned, the operational facilities, that we look at UK and American safety standards. But in terms of construction standards, in terms of integrity of buildings, the visual impact of buildings, the environmental features of buildings, these are jointly agreed with the Americans. And indeed, I don't think there was any facility at Greenham that was regarded by the local authority or by the local community as being significantly obtrusive or causing any particular hurt to the environment or to the eye, to the visual gaze across the common. yes, there was certain controversy over the watchtowers, any missile facility, whether it's American, British, or anybody else's. You have these large watchtowers for security, and I don't think that anybody would underestimate the need for that element of physical security. And that was probably the only feature of all the site that attracted attention. It's still there, and it is merely a large platform on which you have observers and a certain amount of equipment to identify what's happening underneath. But all of this, as I said, was going on as the base was developing. And remember, we were still in early 1983. Missiles haven't arrived. Part of my role at that time was to increase the relationship between the Americans as they came in and with the local community. To do this, I had what was called a community relations advisor. And this lady, who was a local lady, was responsible for, I think we use the term, inducting the Americans in the ways of life in Britain. And basically, as all these new arrivals came into the country, came onto the base, they went through roughly a one-week induction program, in which this good lady had a significant part, explaining, you know, everything from how to order beer, and the difference between the different types of ales we have in this country, customs, shopping, local area, all the tourist facilities, all the facilities for recreation off base, these sort of things. And I also got involved in this, of course, to explain the difference between the United States Air Force and the Royal Air Force, for example, difference in ranks, how to identify them, and so on and so forth. But the idea was, I say, as these increasing numbers of Americans came in, was to introduce them to the UK, to introduce them to the Newbury area, and to enable them to integrate easily and just to enable them to integrate easily into the local community.
Could I ask you a bit more about this sort of relationship between the RAF and the USAF, and particularly your own role? You know, you were the top person, weren't you, the top RAF officer. How did you get on with your American counterpart? You know, would he have been over you, or were you sort of equal?
Right. As far as the command structure of the base is concerned, I've said that the top American, as known as the wing commander, is a full colonel. And he had about five other full colonels working for him, but he was the top dog, he was the wing commander. And he was the senior USAF officer. I was the senior RAF officer, I was the Royal Air Force commander, although I was subordinate to him in rank. Our responsibilities merged in certain areas. Essentially, the operation of the base and the missile facility was that of the Americans. The development of the construction facilities, the infrastructure of the base, the day-to-day operation of the external security of the base was my responsibility. I was responsible for the Royal Air Force Police, the Royal the Ministry of Defence Police, integrating with the Thames Valley Police or any other police force. We were responsible, if you like, for the perimeter security. The American responsibility was for the missile site when the missiles arrived and security of the missiles. And to achieve this, as I think I've already mentioned, that force, subordinate to the American commander, included one-third Royal Air Force. These were security personnel. They didn't belong to me. They belonged to the wing. And they worked to the Americans in providing a joint security response force for the missiles when they arrived. They would be responsible for guarding the site and responsible for guarding the convoys when they deployed. But at this time, we're talking about the Royal Air Force Police on base were part of perimeter security and therefore came under my command, not under the command of the Americans. It was very strictly adhered to, or really trying to strictly adhere to it, that if anyone had to confront one of the demonstrators, it would be a Brit, not an American. The Ministry of Defence Police in the first instance, Royal Air Force Police, secondly, Brit military of any other persuasion, finally, if we were inside the base. We attempted at all times to keep the Americans out of the firing line. There were two good reasons for this. Firstly, the American way of dealing with people entering the base would be slightly different to our own. And secondly, that it would also possibly provide the demonstrators or anyone making an incursion with far greater political propaganda to say I was beaten up in Britain by an American or I was arrested by an American serviceman. The powers of arrest, the responsibility for security against incursion around the perimeter of the base was a British responsibility. The Americans, as I say, would be responsible for the security of the missiles and the security of other of their own premises within the perimeter. So if you like, if you can visualise the wire going all the way around the base as the outer perimeter, there's responsibility of the UK forces, the Ministry of Defence, police, myself, to as far as possible defend that perimeter. Inside there you had, when it was finally built, the Gamma site, the missile site, which was to full nuclear security protection standards. And ultimately, once the weapons would be in place, live armed guards would be in there. And if anybody got in through that fence, they could be shot. There's no argument about it, they would be shot. Our purpose in life was to make sure nobody got as far as being able to get through the further defence lines. The outer perimeter was British. The inner perimeter is NATO. I won't use American. It was a NATO defence facility. But it was guarded by a mixture of British and American personnel. Two-thirds American, one-third British. Incursion into a live nuclear area is met with total force. And that would be the final result had anybody got in there. But as I said, nobody ever did. And as far as I know, no one ever has got into any of the British military nuclear facilities to the point where they have to be taken out by offensive action.
So that would have applied to Green and Women, had they made it into that inner?
If the missiles were there, not when it was a building site. While it was a building site, it was not defended. We were not live armed at any stage. It is we are not the only time you defend with live weapons in peacetime, or sorry, with live ammunition in peacetime, are nuclear weapons, simply because of the terrorist attraction for them. We don't know if somebody comes in there whether they are terrorists or merely protesters. You don't just wait to ask the question. But, as I said, that situation didn't arise in any of the time that I was there because I left before any missiles came into the base. But that would be the plan in the final analysis. And that's why you have these more elaborate inner fences, inner sanctums, fortress points within the outer perimeter. So you can get onto the airfield, into the outer perimeter, it doesn't matter. I mean, even when the missiles were there, you drove past the missile site, and no problem with that. It's getting into the inner sanctum, that is the thing, to stop anybody getting there. That wasn't a problem, I say, in my time. But the relationships with the Americans were always very good. I say, constant access to and liaison with the American commander. Daily contact, of course, with both his security staff, his own security staff, because they were there inside, but we kept them briefed. The American engineers, civil engineers, who worked closely with the Property Services Agency in the development of the plans for the construction of buildings, and with the communications staff and all the other people who were there. So it was a constant liaison job, as much as anything else.
Were there any problems with the sort of the lower ranks? You know, I was thinking of wartime and they're oversexed, overpaid over here, you know, this sort of complaint about the Americans. Did you ever have any of that?
No. I've said we had no significant problems. I'm not saying it didn't happen. There were punch-ups, of course. We occasionally had to put the odd pub off limits to the Americans. But it would have been put off limits if it had been a big RAF station, or maybe the same pubs were off limits to the army guys from Hermitage or from Thatcham, for the simple reason that there were notorious pubs. All the local hookers or something went there. And if you want to avoid trouble, you just put them off limits. Well, of course there were punch-ups, but I said nothing untoward. Nothing that would be any different to a large British garrison being on the doorstep. In fact, to be honest, probably less in some regards. When you consider the problem in some of the pubs around Aldershot and Tidworth and Lark Hill and places like this, I would say their boys, by and large, the majority of the GIs were actually quite well behaved. But then they were well briefed when they arrived. And they were always told, you know, try not to pick a fight, because although you may think you're quite right and you're the aggrieved party, I said, somebody's going to make some political capital out of it. So regrettably, in the interest of the greater good, try not to get yourself into that situation.
As well as having the responsibility for the base, you know, for the sort of changeover to receiving cruise missiles, Did you have anything to do with the deployment sites outside? You know, where crews was going to be deployed from?
Yes, but I don't think it would be appropriate to comment on that one. Yes, I was very much involved. Okay.
So, another point I was going to make, you know, with all the demonstrations that you've described earlier, you know, did this hinder the work, you know, your job of getting the base ready for crews? You know, or did it make it more expensive? You mentioned the extra personnel who were brought in at various times.
I would think it certainly made it more expensive, but to be truthful, I have no idea what that would represent. Ministry of Defence, police on overtime. I mean, the Royal Air Force police existed. I mean, whether they were guarding our place or guarding somewhere else, they were paid for. The same with the military that was brought in. The local police, the civilian police, certainly I should think it cost a mint of money in overtime. But I honestly couldn't give figures. I have no idea what that would amount to. I know my establishment of Ministry of Defence Police was significantly increased. But again, there were people to look after the day-to-day aspects of admin and finance for the police. In terms of total impact, I can honestly say that although the demonstrations, the incursions that we had, the whole of this protest movement that was surrounding the base at times and then getting inside occasionally, my honest assessment must be to say that it was more of an irritation than anything else. We completed all our work on schedule. The base became operational on schedule. Every phase of the work was completed, I think with one exception, on schedule. And the exception was caused because we had some faulty equipment that had to be replaced. It was an irritant. It was, I think we would, I would certainly recognise the whole thing was very much a sort of politically motivated, opportunistic attempt to prevent the deployment of cruise missiles in the UK, but in that regard it manifestly failed. You see, if one goes, and I'm now going beyond my own remit because I was not at the base when the missiles arrived, but going back to my starting point where I referred to Francis Pym saying that these things were there to provide a counter to the Warsaw Pact, and if they were successful they wouldn't be there forever. Well, we see now they haven't been there forever. I think the missiles, in fact, I would be quite clear in my own mind in saying that I believe the missiles made a significant contribution to the breaking down of the Berlin Wall and the outbreak of peace that now exists between what was the Soviet Union and NATO. If we hadn't been able to bargain with those missiles, not just at Greenham Common, but at Molesworth, Dielen in the Netherlands, I forget the names of the other bases, we wouldn't have been able to trade away a complete weapon system. Until the arrival of crews, we had nothing to compensate for. I can't remember if it was the SS-20 or whatever the Soviet equivalent was. It gave us a bargaining counter. It gave us peace, eventually, although the peace that we have at the moment. So I have no qualms in saying that I think it was a jolly good thing. And to consider that the protests were instrumental in removing it is absolutely wrong. There was no way this happened. The missiles were put in as a bargaining counter. The bargain was struck. The MBFR teams looked at all the resources between the East and the West, between the Warsaw Pact and NATO, and they traded down on a weapons system which included the GLCMs. So I think its purpose was served. And as I say, despite all the hassle, I mean, there were many sleepless nights, there was a lot of period of anxiety, a lot of concerns over many things. But at no time did we lose sight of the aim of getting the base operational. And as I said, all targets were met. The only thing which was a sort of personal concern, I suppose, to me, was that for much of the time it appeared that, well, at least I felt that I was almost in isolation. I had a direct line of access to the Ministry of Defence, but not out to my command. I don't know the military, there's a command structure. You basically go from the Ministry of Defence to a command. For my purposes, it was called Royal Air Force Support Command at Brampton, and then that would come down to me. There was also an RAF liaison officer at Mildenhall, 3rd Air Force, to whom I also reported. But on a normal station, if you've got a problem, you need assistance, you go to your command headquarters, and they will, if necessary, go to the Ministry of Defence, who will allocate resources in from other commands. There wasn't a sort of staff officer at support command that I could go to very often about anything. I was going direct to the Ministry of Defence, and even to get police out of my own support command, I went up the line to the Ministry of Defence, and the order went down to support command to provide me with the support. Once we had the relationship set up, I mean, the chief RAF policeman, I mean, commander of security at support command was superb. We had the provost marshal visit and things like this, but I felt that, I mean, there are very few RAF commanders in any station in the UK who've got direct line access to a minister, which is what I had for a short while, and I used it to evict people, who would be able to, or find himself at 5 o'clock in the evening called up to brief the minister in a couple of hours' time about the state of progress with the construction, or if they'd heard there was some particular problem over any facet, to go and brief ministers. And this was done without any reference to my command headquarters. They just really didn't want to know. And one got I got the impression anyway, that because it was all a bit horrid and political, if they kept back out of it and anything went wrong, then they could say, "Oh, that sod Meredith have got it all wrong, and it's nothing to do with us." And they could wash their hands of it. That was a feeling of isolation part of the time. I must say, it didn't actually bother me too much. But it certainly was apparent. And indeed, the chap I handed over to refused to accept this situation. And indeed, he insisted on getting somebody senior to himself in to command the RAF side of the operation, who was co-equal to in rank to the American colonels, sent in by the commander-in-chief to take the can in case anything actually went wrong. And in fact, by the time I'd handed over, you know, most of, I think, the big problems were over anyway. But that was a sort of a slight feeling of isolation. But in terms of getting a job done, it was great. I thoroughly enjoyed it. As I said, it was busy. It was very, very busy. It was very demanding. You had no time to yourself. But it was a job worth doing. And you see, part of the byproduct of getting this job done, I mentioned this international air tattoo. We're now into 83, and we're into the situation where it's been announced that, you know, the missiles will be coming in October or off the back of my head, and I've got no references to it. I can't even remember when they were scheduled to come in. But, you know, we were going to have our last big air show, and our last big air show we did have in 83. I know the air show was actually in July that year, and preceding this we had several visits. We had the commander-in-chief of Allied Forces Central Europe, and I think we had a couple of other high-priced Americans visiting the base, each of which generated a certain element of protest. Skipping back really out of secret back to February, we had the biannual NATO exercise Wintex. No secret about the fact it was an exercise, it was in all the papers, but for whatever reason, some of the protesters decided to use that as a reason for protesting, as if the missiles were already here. Well, of course, manifestly, they weren't in place. But this prompted it. So what you were getting was, instead of having lots of, in inverted commas, spontaneous demonstrations on a large scale, they were now targeted either at particular visits or particular events, such as this exercise, such as CNC visits. And they were better organised and better controlled than they had been before. Serious problems, in fact, arose on one of them because of the sophistication of the communications equipment which they had been issued with or managed to acquire for controlling their demonstration. But nonetheless, we had the technology, as they say, and this was Britkit, nothing to do with the Americans, and we were able to cope with the situation. Back to our convoys, back to this sort of thing. This was earlier in the year. But what we were worried about, and this is why I mentioned the air show, was that major efforts would be made to really sabotage this air show. Well, as I said, the natives in Newbury regard it very much as their show, although it had been declared that this would be the last at Greenham Common, simply because it would be untenable, really, to have a major airshow of the scale and caliber of IAT, which attracts, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. I mean, it really is a colossal airshow with real-world live missiles on the base. So reluctantly, that had to be accepted. So IAT and everybody involved with this, and I was very closely involved with it, were determined to make this into a, you know, the biggest and the best. And as I said, we were very, very concerned about the extent of demonstration, the protest movements, so whether they would target the air show. And I must say here that it was refreshing to find that I mentioned the various Anglo-American society, the sort of local community groups and things. The locals really took the air show to their heart, and the word was passed by whatever means that nobody is going to stop this air show. Intelligence information coming in suggested that there would be a fairly determined attempt to stop the air show. But in the event, it didn't happen. The few people who tried to get in with banners, protest banners, were promptly evicted by the people on the gate. Several people tried to get over the fence onto the flight line were hauled back by members of the public. I think it was three girls who tried to unravel three CND banners were promptly sat upon by the crowd and bodily thrown out of the gates. And there was no protest. And that's a fantastic, superb flying display of the type that only IAT could produce was held in that year. And in fact, Hazeltine, I forget what appointment he was holding at that stage, he was the sort of senior political guest, if you like, at the air show. Also, one young Jordanian prince who I had to look after for part of the day, who was a delightful character. But despite all this attention, all the aircraft, all the people, all the prestige, all the media that was there, again, I think the protesters appreciated that, you know, whatever they did, it was not going to be facing the media and facing the security personnel. It was going to be facing the real British public. And on that basis, they backed off and didn't make any effort. I should say that Mr. Hazeltine had been on the base earlier in the year to look round the construction site before we sort of finally took it over. And indeed, one of the things that there was May the 24th was designated as CND Women's Day, and this was supposed to be one of the big demonstrations. I think it was called because actually they were hoping that Mr. Hazeltine was going to be there on that particular day. In fact, it didn't coincide. And this demonstration, although it attracted large numbers, in fact, I was actually away. I was down on a naval weapons range when it happened. But you know, there's obviously nothing that's a consequence. Nobody phoned me up to say we got problems, so I assume that went off okay. But on June the 10th, I say, we actually had the formal board where we took over the missile site. That was operationally ready by that stage. A lot of other peripheral things to finish. But that was it. I say, Mr. Hazeltine had been there to see that just before we took over. We had the Welford, the Anglo-American Fair. Again, no interference. Nobody would dare do so. And we had the, largest demonstrations in July. And I say, we thought that these were going to lead through to the air show, but they didn't. And so the air show went off perfectly well. There was a corollary to this, though, that when the air show finished on the Sunday, the second day of the show, I said, again, the Royal Air Force responsible for security for the air show. But the Americans, the Royal Air Force responsible for security, all the aircraft involved in the show. But the Americans chose to pull two aircraft out of the line. One was the SR-61, which is the strategic reconnaissance aircraft, and the other was, I think it was a TSR-2. Oh, it was a spy plane again. I think Gary Powers was shot down years and years before.
U-2.
They pulled both of these aircraft off the line, which were guarded by the RAF, and they put them on the south side of the airfield and to guard them themselves. And in fact, during the night, through one of these bushy, very difficult areas to defend, some of these women came. And their intention, we understand it, was to paint CND symbols and things all over this SR-61. Well, in fact, they were intercepted by a dog patrol. And they, instead of getting to the aircraft, they threw cans of paint in the general direction. But in fact, it spread some of it on the U-2 aircraft and not on the SR-61. I think, to be absolutely fair, there were a couple of flecks of paint on the tyre. But the aircraft itself was not damaged or taken out of the line. It flew off back to its base, well, come daylight. The other aircraft ended up a couple of panels replaced because the paint actually attacks the special protective anti-sort of radar finish they have on these aircraft. But, you know, this was again claimed as a great sort of demonstration or protest victory. They damaged this, this very expensive, very, they said, you know, disreputable sort of aircraft that spies on innocent communists and things like this. Whereas, in fact, I say the aircraft wasn't, and as I said, the staff tie for that actual air show was decided to be the SR-61, and there's quite a lot of these ties around now from people who were actually there. And it was shortly after the air show that I actually gave up, or left Greenham Common, and took up a new appointment in the Ministry of Defence. And I think the sort of concluding part of all I've got to say of this is that it was a challenging and demanding 3 years. There was very little peace for me. In fact, I don't think I had more than a few days leave in all the time I was there. But having said that, you know, I actually, as strange as it may seem, I actually enjoyed it. There's nothing better than keeping yourself busy. It was a job worth doing, and it was a job that was achieved insofar as, I say, we met all the operational readiness targets. And despite the inconvenience, despite the hassle, despite the undoubted additional cost or to, because of the security as much as...